Hey folks, it's Nat and Allie here. We just wanted to step in before the episode to add a content warning. This episode deals very frankly with sexualized violence, sexual abuse, just straight up violence. Everything you can think of is in this movie. And so we just wanted to put a little something up top to say that we're going to talk very frankly about all of this. And so, yeah.
If you need like a cozier movie,
yes,
then go back to what's a film that of ours that doesn't, is cozier.
I'm looking up
Barbarella. Barbarella.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a story, and if it entertains you, maybe you'll decide to help me research further. And if not, I'll do the washing up and you'll never see me again. You know, you should eat that.
What kind of research?
Elizabeth. Oh, can I call you Elizabeth? I want you to help me catch a killer of women.
This is Snails and Oysters. And welcome back to Snails and Oysters, your bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bi-sexual, bi-valent movie podcast, where we are halfway through our October horror spooky month special. Last week we talked about, I'm Nat Roberts.
And I'm Allie Rogers.
And last week we talked about The Lost Boys, a very campy, fun horror movie. And this week we are talking about The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, a truly horrifying movie in the best possible way.
Yes, definitely. Definitely a scary movie, a bit of an October movie. But less like, I mean, The Lost Boys is a vampire.
Yeah.
You know, it's a supernatural scary story. This is just like
people being terrible. Yeah. The two sides, the duality of horror.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of horrific things, how'd you like that segue?
It's very funny to me.
Last week news broke that
Sydney Sweeney is going to be starring in a remake of Barbarella, which is blowing my mind.
One of the worst movies we've ever talked about on this show. Up there with like Deadly Illusions for quality.
I am so shocked because like the sexual politics of that movie are so regressive.
Right. That's the thing. It's got regressive sexual politics, but it's also got a lot of explicit sex, neither of which are things that most movies are comfortable dealing with these days. One, justifiably, the other because of censorship. So I have no idea what this movie is going
to
be.
It's also just weird to me because I love the idea of like a babe in space.
Mm, totally.
Saving the world. There's nothing about that that I have an issue with, but I'm just kind of like, could we not have written an original film?
Yeah.
That was just like a sexy babe in space. It's just really weird. And the only thing that makes sense to me is just that Jane Fonda starred in Barbarella and she was bombshell.
It is based on a comic book and like it is where Duran Duran, the band, got their name.
No. But all I'm saying, what I was trying to say was that like the only thing that makes sense to me is that like Sydney Sweeney wants to be seen in the way that Jane Fonda was seen. Like she is the bombshell of our time, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. And also isn't true because Jane Fonda is a great actress and that's all I have to say.
Oh no. We will not be doing Sydney Sweeney slander on this podcast. Are you kidding?
Okay, I haven't watched White Lotus. I've heard she's very good.
What have you seen with her in it? That this slander is coming
just
from.
Just like bits and pieces. I don't know. I don't watch Euphoria.
My
so
guy's
I really
watching
can't
clips
talk.
On Twitter and deciding that she's a bad actress.
It's a bad habit. I shouldn't do it.
No, she's good.
I do think Jane Fonda's better.
She's
though.
A master at this move that I think is sweeping young actresses everywhere, which is the crying while eyelids do not fully close.
Interesting. I generally think I will be shocked if this movie ever actually hits theaters.
Oh yeah, you texted me. You think, what do you think is going to die in development?
I think so many movies like this are announced and then don't go anywhere. Like it's similar with the Blade movie with Mahershala Ali that they announced, but like they haven't attached anybody else to, and it's. It's the same thing where it's like they just announced the star and the title of the remake and set a date for it, but then like scrambled to get it done on time. Yeah. So I don't know. I think that's not Sydney Sweeney's fault. I will say that is Hollywood's fault, but I would not be surprised that it either gets delayed, gets stuck in development hell, she drops out and the project dies. You know, there's a million one ways that these things happen, but if it comes
to a theater near me, I will be there.
Yeah.
Like I will be there.
Well, if there's someone bisexual in it, if they don't change the Black Queen, we will have to talk about it.
Oh my God. I wonder if they'll bring back the organ.
Oh my God. Honestly, the organ might be the only salvageable part of the original. The organ. Because it was just so weird.
No, I think it's the deadly rabbits for sure. Or whatever they were, the deadly children?
The fucking dolls with teeth.
Dolls with teeth, that's what it was.
Yeah. Oh, God. All right, that's about as much as I'm comfortable thinking about the movie Barbarella. Shall we get into this week's episode?
Yes, let's get into it.
The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is a 2011 adaptation of Stieg Larsson's 2005 novel, Men Who Hate Women. It is a neo-noir thriller horror epic,
Revenge. Yeah.
With a screenplay by Steven Zaillian and directed by David Fincher, starring Daniel Craig as journalist Mikael Blomkvist and Rooney Mara as the coolest woman to ever exist, Lisbeth Salander.
The film starts with our journalist, Mikhail, taking an L, a big L.
Big L.
Where he loses a slander case. He'd written a big story.
Please, a libel case. As J. Jonah Jameson in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man taught us in print, it's libel.
He loses a big libel case. He'd written this kind of expose on a billionaire. Mm-hmm. And he loses in court, and he's dating the editor of the newspaper where he had printed the story, and he's kind of going down for the both of them.
Yeah, he's taking the fall.
Yeah, and he resigns to kind of save the fate of the paper.
Mm-hmm. And
But luckily,
at the same time, Mikhail's background is being checked by Lisbeth, a private investigator for a larger security firm, because another billionaire, eccentric billionaire Henrik Wanger, played by Christopher Plummer, wants to hire Mikhail to investigate the 40-year-old disappearance of his grandniece, Harriet, which happened back in the 1960s. The only people who could have been involved in her disappearance are other members of Wanger's large and largely unsympathetic family.
Very fucked up.
Who all live on this isolated island far to the north.
Yeah. So Mikhail gets to set up shop in a little very cold-looking cottage on the property of the island and slowly investigate the various members of this family. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile,
Lisbeth is a ward of the state who has to deal with a new guardian after her old one suffers a near fatal stroke. And she is placed in the creepy, creepy hands of one Bierman who uses his position as her guardian to rape her twice.
Repeatedly.
Yeah. Only for Lisbeth to turn the tables and rape him back and threaten to destroy his entire life if he doesn't do exactly what she says.
Yeah.
That's all in like the first half of the movie before the two leads even meets.
Yeah. The two leads come together when does he find out about
her? Mikhail needs a research assistant.
Right, totally. But then how does he know to look for her? What was it?
I think it's the lawyer who hired Mikhail. Mikhail asks him for a research assistant and he's like, oh, I have the perfect person. She did your background check.
Exactly. Yeah. So he shows up to her house, or her apartment, I should say, and she's kind of rebuffing him, like, ugh, I'm not interested in working for you. But guess what? He shows her the case, and she is completely captivated by the strangeness of the case. Because another important thing to note is that the reason, one of the reasons that, like, it's only could have been members of his family is that there was an accident on the bridge before she disappeared. So access...
Right, that blocked off access.
Access to the family island was totally isolated. And so Elizabeth is totally hooked.
I believe, like, what he says to really get her on board is that he wants her help to find a killer of women. Mm. Because he's realized that whoever...
Yes.
Whoever killed Harriet is most likely a serial killer within the Wenger family. Isn't that what he said? He says, I want you to help me catch a killer of women.
Exactly, yes. Mikkel and Elizabeth, they team up. They use their powers, her powers of hacking, and his powers mostly of...
Looking at photos. I don't know
he does a lot of
looking
are.
At photos. Looking at photos. Good questions.
He does so much looking. but she definitely emerges the stronger detective, I think. They find the killer.
Who turns out to be the one seemingly normal member of the Wenger family, Martin, whose father was a serial killer, and now he is a serial killer.
Runs in the family.
Yep.
Not a great bonding activity for fathers and sons.
No. I think a game of catch would be the traditional
Much
father-son bonding activity.
Mikkel is almost killed.
Yep.
By the serial killer. Lisbeth, because she's badass, kills... actually ends up killing him, or he kind of kills himself. It's a car accident.
She forces him off the road. I'd say she gets
credit. Forces him off the road. The car explodes, as they do in movies.
As they do. And Mikkel realizes that Martin didn't, in fact, kill his sister, Harriet. She secretly escaped to England with the help of a cousin who has since passed away.
She took on, like, a different identity to do this.
Basically.
Yeah.
So then, in the end... Mikkel is able to reunite Henrik with his beloved grandniece, sort of healing, almost healing this generational trauma, or at least setting them on the road to.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of therapy. But anyways, great film. That's the film.
Yep.
Highly recommend.
Don't forget, there's a great sort of end sequence where Elizabeth sort of goes back to the beginning of the movie to destroy the billionaire who had sued Mikkel for libel in the first place.
Right. Yes.
She takes
all his money.
Yeah, she takes all his money and then leaves him to be killed by his gang associates.
Yep.
It's great.
Brutal. She's brutal.
Yeah. So as many people know, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is part of a trilogy of novels. And this film was originally intended to be the first in a film adaptation trilogy. As we will get into, it did not work out that way.
What do we want?
We want, well, it's kind of too late.
What do we want? Another
Yeah, we want Girl Rooney with the Mara Dragon Tattoo as Lisbeth Salander.
When do we want it?
In 2013, no! 2014, yeah.
yeah
it would have been good.
I mean, I'll take 2024.
yeah, they haven't aged that much, the actors. They're still around. So, Allie, had you seen The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo before?
Okay, so it's so funny because I am... 90% sure. 99% sure.
99% sure.
I almost was like, do I even need to rewatch this movie? Because when they first came out, I watched both the Swedish one and the American one. I was like, I went through a phase. so I have seen this movie before. I saw the Swedish one and I felt really confident that I knew exactly the plot of this movie. And within 20 minutes, it became clear to me that I remembered... two scenes from this film.
I mean, in your defense, it's nearly 3 hours long. But
yes.
Unlike the last 3 hour long film we covered, The Batman, I would say that this one warrants it.
I would agree. I would also say that it's full of plot. Things are happening.
Things are always happening in this movie. And some of them are the most fucked up things I've ever seen.
Yeah. And it's a good spooky. So today's like a really good spooky, our first kind of fall day. I literally woke up because of like the sound of thunder, literally thunder cracking above my head woke me up, and then it's been like windy and dark and moody. So it felt like this is like a very moody
and a very film. Swedish day. It sounds
very Swedish. Yeah.
Not that I've never been to Sweden. I hear it's a lovely country. the Sweden presented in this film, on the other hand,
the Sweden presented in this film, you can't get into.
No. Well, I mean, I can as a movie. I just wouldn't want to live.
Sure. There. So had you seen this movie before?
I have. I've never seen the Swedish version, but I did watch this movie, not when it came out, but a few years later. And I'm pretty sure it was one of those movies where I watched it. I said, that was one of the best movies I've ever seen, and I hope I never see it again. And here we are. Because that's the thing. Jokes aside, like, this is an incredible movie. I feel like this is one of the most discussed movies on like, all video essay channels across the internet. Like, some of my favorites, like Lessons from the Screenplay and Captain Christian, have done videos specifically about Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. David Fincher is a much discussed director. But yeah, this movie is so well done in such a weird way. Like, it's not just that they executed a formula well, it's that there was no formula, but it works really well.
That's interesting. Yeah, I want to hear you talk more about that, because definitely just watching it, what's so kind of funny about this movie is it's two different movies for the first, I don't know, half. Like,
literally the first half. The two main characters don't meet until the midpoint, which is like, that goes against everything you're told about how to tell a story. But here it just works so well immediately.
Well, and it's not just that they don't meet, like, mm-hmm. It's also, like, I feel like some films will do that, but it's like, oh, they just happen to be working on the same case. But it's like, except, like, they're not connected really in any way, except they become connected through her security firm.
Yeah, it's like she does the background check on Mikhail. So Elizabeth does the background check on Mikhail before the movie happens. And then, like, she has her own fucking movie in the first half where she, you know, the entire subplot about her being a ward of the state isn't, it's not that it's resolved, but the arc of it happens in the first half of the movie. And then the rest of the movie progresses with that as understood backstory.
Yeah. And like, it's really interesting because I really only remembered her part of the film.
Really interesting.
Like, going into this film, yeah, I was like, this is a film about Elizabeth Salander escaping her, you know,
shitty legal guardian.
Yeah. And then, like, so to actually rewatch it and be like, that's actually just the setup. And that's how you get to know that she does not fuck around.
My God.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. And it's especially interesting because, let's talk about the structure first. And with the understanding that this film was kind of meant to set up a trilogy. Like, David Fincher wasn't attached to direct all three, but all the major actors were. Every character who showed up in the next two movies, you know, in theory, had to be cast for this one and show up and have lines. But then it just never happened because I dug into it, and the only explanation I could find is that Steven Zaillian, who wrote the adaptation for this movie, was working on the script of the second one, and Sony decided he was taking too long. So they scrapped the entire franchise, hired new director, new writer, new cast, based it off of one of the, like, legacy sequels to this series that was not written by Stieg Larsson, and it bombed. Huge. But, you know, if they – and this was, like – just 3 years after this movie came out, they announced they were rebooting the entire franchise. And then it still took another 3 years, 3 or 4 years, for that movie to come out.
Wait, so are you saying there's a second American
kind
version?
Of. There's a movie called The Girl Caught in the Spider's Web, which is based on a novel by a different author who was given permission by the estate to write to continue the series. But it has, like, Claire Foy from The Crown in it, and none of the original cast.
Wow.
Fincher and Zaillian were not involved in any way.
That's super weird.
It pretty much came out, and then everyone forgot that it happened, which is sort of the polar opposite of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
That is wild.
Yeah. And it's incredibly disappointing, honestly, because it was set up sort of to be, like, a hard R franchise. And you can see it in like the opening title sequence. There are images from the later books in the opening titles, like a phoenix and things like that that come up in later books. But yeah, it just is it's kind of a setup with no payoff. Although I will say, like, I read an interview that Fincher, the director, gave with Screenwire, and he said, like, he always meant this film to stand on its own, even as part of a series.
Okay, but can I be honest about that line?
Go for it.
I feel like filmmakers always say that.
Yeah, totally, totally.
You know, they never want to be like, you can only appreciate my film
if you watch two more films.
Yeah.
I will say, though, on the other hand, like, we've all seen film trilogies where the third one is kind of meh because, like, it can't stand on its own. It's just about paying off the other two movies. Like, I think Patrick Willems, another video essayist, has a whole video about how trilogies never seem to land or almost never seem to land.
Well, and I will say that I know that I walked out of one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Yeah, great example.
I just can't remember if it was the third or fourth or fifth one.
I only saw the first three. After they resolved at least some of the story, I cashed my chips in. But yeah, so anyway, but that's not even like the least of what makes this film interesting. Like it's such a structural achievement, really. Like Zalian spent like 6 months on the script, half of which was just reading and rereading the book and making notes and trying to condense it into an intelligible, manageable film.
I mean, I think it really works.
Yeah.
I think of the few critiques I have, one would be, there's just a lot of scenes where someone's holding up a photograph and
yeah, there's a lot of holding up photos.
It's like, this is an important photograph.
Yeah. And it's remarkable that it's as watchable as it is, even though you're right, a lot of it is just like, oh, this face looks like this face and this mark is this mark. On the other hand, the alternative is, you know, I think a lesser director would hold up photographs and then have someone say what's in the photograph. Yes. That's important.
And I will say, we didn't get the like Always Sunny in Philadelphia like photograph wall. We got like versions of it, yeah, but tasteful versions. We didn't get like the totally manic, you know, Claire Danes in Homeland.
Like, red string conspiracy. Right. Yeah. And it's remarkable, like, people have gone through. So something that is also worth noting here is that, like, there's a lot of visual effects in this movie that you would not notice.
Really?
Like, all of Mikhail's notes on the wall, like, were, most of them were digitally altered to keep them consistent throughout the movie. Or like, Captain Christian has an incredible video about this that I'll link in the description. Things like Lisbeth's bangs. When she has bangs, there will be a little split in them.
Yeah.
And they did that in post to make sure that the little split in her hair was always in the exact same spot.
Oh, that's crazy. I can't tell if I'm like impressed by that or I find it silly. Like,
pissed off. Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Why did you care?
Yeah.
So yeah, like, I guess this is all sort of to say, this is like a meticulously built film, like from a script to a directing to an acting perspective. This is one of those movies. This is sort of the polar opposite of a Robert Altman or an Agnes Varda film, where you find things in the edit room or you know, shoot things from two angles at once. Like, this is a David Fincher movie. Everything has been perfectly set from the beginning.
Yeah, it's funny. My most recent other experience with David Fincher is my my boyfriend was like, we should watch Seven.
Oh, fun.
I've never seen Seven, and I
still haven't, to be honest.
Okay, it's worth a watch, but it's so dreary. It's like, you if you only watch Seven, you were like, that's what New York is. You'd be like, it rains every day. But like, I don't know. It's just interesting because this was a very like a much more polished aesthetic than Seven, and much less kind of doom and gloom. I don't know. I'm speaking in very basic terms about.
I think you're right.
I'm sure someone else who's like a true Fincherite could.
Ah, fuck it. Fuck him.
Fuck the Fincherites.
Fincher's fine. His fans are annoying. That's it. Like, I don't even consider myself that big. I don't think I could say I'm a fan of David Fincher just because, like I said, when I saw this movie, I never wanted to see it again. Like, I don't have strong enough a stomach for his movies most of the time.
I will say this is, has such a brutal rape scene. It is. I mean, it actually technically has two rape scenes.
Actually, I would say three or four if you start counting you're flashbacks. Totally right. And things.
Yeah. It's really a movie about sexual violence.
I was gonna say, I knew that was gonna be a big part of the conversation, so let's get right into it. Cause the original Swedish title of the book is Men Who Hate Women. Mm. And I feel like that is, if anything, a more apt title because on every level, in every possible context, we see male characters abuse and have disdain for women. Yeah. From the personal to the systemic to the political to the geopolitical, it's all there, you know, and it's all presented as one connected apparatus of control, which is it's incredibly well executed, but it's also incredibly disturbing to watch. So, sorry, I went off there.
But. No, it's just really, really interesting. Just even that title change, because the girl with the dragon tattoo makes you think, obviously, of the girl with the dragon tattoo. And there's a lot about Lisbeth's look in this film that's very as the viewer, you're really drawn to her.
She's instantly iconic.
And I also think you're clearly supposed to understand how kind of off-putting her image is to other people and how it kind of sets her apart. So it's kind of easy to go into this film thinking this is a film about Lisbeth Salander and whatever her personal traumas might be and how they've affected her. But it's actually really, it's really much more that first original title. But it's something you don't really realize until the end when kind of the full horror of Harriet's story is being told from her point of view.
Totally. I will say on the subject of Lisbeth's look, I was so glad you brought that up because I read a great interview with Rooney Mara where she talked about going to set in costume or going out to lunch while still in costume. And she said it was fantastic because no one looked at her on the street. She said it was the perfect invisibility cloak because, she talked about being a young, conventionally attractive woman with long hair. And, it's the age old story. You get catcalled at the, for no fucking reason at all. But in costume as Lisbeth, no one fucking made eye contact with her. It was a force field around her that redirected everyone's attention because they were don't want to fuck with her. And she said it was a really liberating experience in some ways to play the part.
I believe it. I definitely think when I first watched this film, so that would have been around 2011 when it came out. So I would have been around 18 or 19. And I did just find so – I just thought she was so badass. I was joking during the movie and when she rapes her own rapist, I was like, now this is a girl boss. these other girl bosses don't know what they're doing. But it's funny that you say that about Rooney Mara, because I feel like even as a viewer, I just felt so so attracted to that armor that this character had put around herself.
Armor is a perfect word for it. I mean, it's great because the design of the character reflects her backstory in a way that's never explicitly said, it's heavily, heavily implied that she has this trauma goes back to childhood. She tried to kill her dad at 12. People don't do that for no reason. But it's never explicitly stated what happened when, but it's so clear that this is a character of enormous vulnerability who knows how vulnerable she is and has made conscious decisions to protect herself through her look, through her presentation, through, beating the shit out of her rapist, which, abolition all the way. I'd like to take this opportunity to go on the record as saying that I think it's it's our moral obligation to beat up rapists. But there's this other side to her character that really shines through in the last act of the movie when it's the mystery is solved and it's more about her relationship with Mikhail. And we suddenly see all of this softness come out of her. Mm-hmm. These tender feelings towards him that are expressed in such childlike terms where she says, like, I made a friend. She writes him a card with a horse on the front of it. You know, it's very sweet. And it's such a wonderful contrast. And it's so true to life, in my experience at least, of the people who put up the most barriers have the softest underbelly.
Sorry, when you said underbelly, I just thought of my dog's belly, which I know is not what you were trying to do.
Let's – this is going to be a difficult conversation.
I know. I know. It's hard to know where to even get into it.
Let's talk about the sexual assault scene where Elizabeth's state-appointed legal guardian takes advantage of his position to rape her.
Which the first time?
There's like two different scenes.
Let's
start by talking. I guess we could start by broadening first and talking about how sexual assault is often used in media. Like, what would you say is the typical use in American media?
I don't know. I mean, I guess what comes to mind for me is I think a lot of times it's used as like a backstory.
Yeah.
Or an instigating event, something that might, lead a character down a different path.
Totally.
And what's interesting, I guess, about this movie is it's happening in the middle of her story. Like, she's already fully formed. Elizabeth is Elizabeth. Yeah. Like, to such a degree that after that first blowjob that she's forced to give, that first rape, she purposely comes back with a plan. You know, that's how like fully formed she is as a person.
Totally. And Fincher talked about that, how he was like, he knew they were walking a delicate line where it's like, she's putting herself in danger and the audience doesn't understand why. Yeah. And so it's vitally important to that second time she goes to his house to reveal that it was all a plan, to show that, no, she was thinking about this. She just underestimated what a fucked up guy this is.
Yeah.
And also, I want to say up top that I want to give kudos to Fincher, because he talked a lot in the interview I read about protecting the two actors in the scene, the actual people who had to perform this. He talked about wanting to lock down the set, keep everything tight and close so that they don't feel exposed, make them feel safe so that as they're performing these inhuman situations, they're still in full control and can say like, okay, nope, I need a break and things like that. So
yeah, that's
and Mara echoed those sentiments where it's like it felt very like a very safe space to play.
Yeah, that's really good to hear, because all three of the scenes are just so incredibly disturbing.
Totally. And I think probably the other most frequently cited trope around sexual assault is kind of just Game of Thrones as a trope, where assault is used as a plot point, as a backstory, as justification for various other things, but the experience of survivors is largely tangential to the plot that the writers have in mind.
Game of Thrones is so much about like the worst of what humanity could be in this like fantasy space, and I feel like it's always used to kind of show and measure like the depths of like the sadism of one of the characters, and also to just like constantly reinforce that in this Game of Thrones universe, women are never safe and violence is always around the corner. And that is interesting, because I actually would say a lot of the end of this film gives the impression of like women are not necessarily ever safe and violence could always be lurking, but obviously really different mediums.
Very different, and very different stories, because I feel like what this movie does that Game of Thrones doesn't is put us in the perspective of a victim rather than a bystander. Like, I think rather infamously, Game of Thrones had the scene of Ramsay and Sasha's, was that her name? I've forgotten so much about that show. The Sophie Turner's character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Their wedding night, and it's shot from the perspective of Theon Greyjoy, the guy who's, isn't he sad that this terrible thing is happening to Sansa. That was her fucking name. Jesus. That show left my brain the second it ended. But what this movie does is, in at every opportunity, the direction puts us in Lisbeth's head in every scene. Like, there was a particular shot this time around, the first time she meets Bjorman, her guardian, there's a shot of just her ear and him out of focus, and the sound design is, like, just gorgeous in that scene, and it's very clearly meant to be like, you're in her head.
Yeah.
You're with her.
Yeah.
And so when these bad things happen, we're still with her.
Even showing, like, the aftermath of that first meeting with him, when she just goes to throw up, it's so visceral. And
I mean, talk about visceral, the aftermath of the second meeting with him, where she takes a shower. It's brutal. Yeah. And it's a side of sexual assault that is often sanitized in popular media portrayals, which I think actually has the inverse effect that most people would want, where it makes it look like less of a big deal because there isn't time spent on the physical recovery from it.
And I think the other thing is just that, like, it's I don't know, it's such an interesting set of scenes because when she goes back to his, because I think, like, it's like Game of Thrones, I had to stop watching. I had to take a break for a few seasons because I couldn't take
I
think the violence in general, but also I was like, I can't watch another rape scene. Like, I actually can't do it.
Yeah. And honestly, Game of Thrones, it always felt like they were just trying to, like, impress you with it, where it's like, hey, we went there, man. But that's probably because Benioff and Weiss have always been terrible writers, but that's my own opinion that is not relevant to this film. Anyway, continue.
I was just going to say that, like, when she goes back again and it's her time to have revenge, I don't know, I'm really impressed by the range of emotions that, like, Fincher was able to provoke in me as the viewer, because on the one hand, I just felt this, like, self-righteous, like, yes, fuck this guy. But then he also shoots it in such a way where he's also, I think, showing her caseworker as a victim in that moment, too. Like, it's just an incredibly well done and equally brutal. That's what I mean. It's just like an equally brutal scene, but one that you're kind of, like, rooting for, but also disturbed by.
Yeah, like you see the logic.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you're disturbed by the fact that you're rooting for it. Absolutely. And one of the best things I would say about Bjorman's character, the rapist character, is that he, as I think it was either Fincher or the actor who portrayed him said, he's half affable, where you get the disturbing sense that you have met someone like this and you didn't know it, because he is capable of being perfectly sociable. And in fact, like, it emphasizes his humanity in a way that makes him even more despicable, because he's not a monster. He's not a psychopath. He's not even the most evil character in this movie. There are serial killers and Nazis. But he is particularly disgusting because he is not remarkable.
Well, and I think the best moment of dialogue that kind of exhibits it, actually, there's two. There's one where after he rapes her in his home, he says, do you need a ride home? And he says with this tone of voice that is so truly, like, concerned.
Yeah. You know?
And then when she comes back again the next day, he said, I didn't like how you left things. Like, it's really.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's both gross and it works, you know?
Yeah. That's the thing. And it's I was talking to my partner T about this, and like, they raise the point that, like, humans commit sexual assault, not monsters, you know, not boogeymen. People do it. And that's really the hardest fact to grasp sometimes. And yeah, just kudos to that actor for being willing to play such a terrible character so well.
Yeah.
And big kudos to Rooney Mara. I mean, apart from just this entire performance, which is incredible. But these particular scenes, you know, she talked a lot in the interview I read about how, you know, it was grueling. It was draining to do this work, even with all the protections in place. And even though, you know, it felt like a very satisfying artistic experience, it's physically demanding work. And so, yeah, I would say, like, a scene like this, it's incredibly hard to do right.
Yeah.
And they did, you know, and in a way that reminds you of the humanity of this thing that gets thrown around as a joke or a trope. It brings it back to the personal.
Yeah.
The physical.
I would say, and this is like a very cold take.
Go for it.
But I would say the other thing that this does, these series of scenes do in like the architecture of the film.
Yes.
Is I think they really make you feel like, and you would probably feel this way anyways, having seen David Fincher's films, but they really make you feel like there's a lot of potential for violence in many other scenes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, like they're not extraneous. They are part of the world.
Right. Right. And then, and it just, it really heightens, like for me, those scenes and how brutal they were really heightened the anxiety I felt when Mikael was in the torture room, because I felt like, I know that this director and this movie will go there.
Yeah.
And like the way my whole body was tense, I truly thought we were about to watch some like torture.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's because earlier in the film we'd seen like this movie is not going to shy away, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think the conversation I had with T ended with sort of the idea of like, if you're going to go there, go properly. And they do, where it's like, you know, they're not, it is like there is sex in this movie and there is rape in this movie, and it's very clear which is which. And they, it's not that like it's a completely different aesthetic, but you know, we see the difference, you know, the emotional difference, the physical difference, the just everything. And you know, it's a really important distinction to draw that gets blurred in a lot of popular media, which is really disturbing.
It's just so interesting that this film is about this case, this a seeming case of one woman being disappeared. So you're thinking one act of violence, and then it spirals out towards being about these many, the serial killer. And then it kind of like after spiraling out, like spirals in again to focus back in on that original family and just the actual like childhood sexual abuse happening within that family. And what's so interesting is that we don't see any of the violence that took place within that detective, that like mystery that pushes the film forward, but we only see the violence that happens to Lisbeth and this caseworker. The caseworker really being completely ancillary. Completely ancillary to the actual mystery driving everything forward. Mm.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's like you said, it sets up that this happens in this world and lets our brains fill in the rest.
Yeah. And now I won't sleep tonight.
Yeah, same. But no, that's a really great point that you made that I want to dig into a little bit, is how this case expands and contracts to the point where at its largest it feels like an indictment of the entire country, you know, and at its smallest it's about the relationships between people. And I think it's important to mention at this point that so when I was watching the film this time, I kept thinking like, this has got to be about capitalism, right? Like this has got to be like they're rich and they're evil and it's a family full of Nazis. And I looked it up, and sure enough, Stieg Larsson, the original author of the book that this is based on, was a far left activist, like went to Africa to train Marxist freedom fighters, kind of leftist.
Wow.
And journalist who researched the rise of white nationalism in the far right back in like the early 2000s when no one was talking about it. So yeah, it's very clear that this is a this movie has a particular political lens that it inherited from Larson's writing.
That's interesting. I definitely agree. There's no doubt there is critiques of like wealth and power in this film, but there's also critiques of like what a kind of socialist state can do to an individual person through Lisbeth and kind of like the, which I don't think is like a critique of like socialism as a concept, but
no.
But like, it's interesting watching it. Cause I think, you know, in like liberal circles in the US,
Sweden, we point to Sweden and, as, yeah.
Well, we point to the Nordic states all the time for everything. And what's so funny is we particularly point to them for their social welfare state, their kind of welfare state, but also for their gender equality. So it's really interesting that this film is kind of like showing ways in which, first of all, there's violence against women in Sweden. Sorry, Americans. Yeah. Sorry. And also like the, you know, humans can abuse power in all sorts of ways and all sorts of situations.
Totally. And I would say like it goes even further to like comment on how these like Nordic utopias, so to speak, are still part of a global colonial system. Like I don't think it's an accident that the final serial killer, the final boss, Martin Wanger, targets immigrants. Yeah. You know, he says like just another immigrant whore about one of his victims. And it's because, you know, the country itself doesn't care about these people. And so he's able to prey on them, you know?
Yeah, that's such a gut punch of a line because you realize that Mikhail and Lisbeth have been tracking, you know, they think they're on this huge case. And it's a gut punch because you think, oh, my God, like
it's there is a whole
what
other,
are the names that they don't even know that they'll never know, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that it's the serial killers in the Wanger family, Martin and his father, are a great analogy for how fascism has evolved in the past 50 years, where Martin's father was a religiously themed, patriarchal, sexual serial killer, you know, who was able to prey upon random working class women thanks to his job in a large corporate firm. Whereas Martin Wanger is the CEO of a company who lives in like a very modern house, who has very modern views, who, you know, seems perfectly, he seems like the good guy in the family, but secretly is the worst of the bunch because he has just learned to put a veneer of politeness over this seething darkness. I think actually there's one scene with the grand uncle who's a Nazi. And it's a one-off scene. This guy's been set up the whole time. And there's a line, an exchange in it that I love where he says to Mikhail, basically, thank you. Now I'm forgetting the names. He says to Mikhail, basically, you know, why should I hide the past like they do? Under a thin, shiny veneer like an IKEA table, I am the most honest of all of them. The family? Sweden. You know, it's a real...
I thought that dialogue was so powerful. And I thought the entire way they set up his character in the film was brilliant because they really make you feel like in this family of fuck-ups and shitheads... and monsters. Here's the real monster, you know? And they really make you, and even the Mikhail tries to get out of seeing him, tries to get his daughter to go see him. And it really is such a, I think, good example of how powerful, or not powerful, how like it's a good example of what surprise can do in a narrative. Because it's truly surprising when you get there and he's not particularly rude. He's not particular. He's very like quote unquote friendly. But I thought that exchange was really interesting.
Friendly is a great word for it because as like Martin says later when he has Mikhail tied up, he says like, why didn't you trust your instincts? You know, you knew you were in danger, but you stayed because you were afraid of offending me. And I actually think that, you know, I read a book recently about the Spanish Civil War, which I felt the author tried to present himself as sort of an a, you know, political viewpoint, which is how centrists always try to present themselves. And it was entertaining to read the book with that in mind, because he would say things like, you know, it's remarkable that this fascist who was so brutal during the war was such a nice young man and so polite and so, you know, sophisticated and refined. And I'm like, of course he was. They all are. They all are. That's how they get in.
Yeah.
No one's going to listen to a goose-stepping freak from the beginning. No, they start out charming. They start out friendly. They start out refined. And they go to Darien, Connecticut and say, oh, you know, it's fine for them, but they shouldn't come here. You know, like this is how fascism enters, through the front door.
Yeah, it's definitely the most fucked up family.
Oh yeah,
and that we've seen in a while.
That's
maybe ever on the show.
that's what tipped me off that this movie was about like capitalism, is in that scene when Henrik Wenger, the incomparable Christopher Plummer, sort of introduces the family as this great capitalist dynasty that stitched the country together with their railroads. And boy, howdy, don't you love our country? And then he quickly says, you know, it's full of the worst people you've ever met, literal Nazis. Like, this is the worst family ever. And it's like, oh, yeah, yeah. And even Heinrich, the good quote unquote Wenger, the only one who, you know, apart from Harriet, isn't pure evil, he still is kind of a schmuck, where he promises Mikhail revenge on his enemy Venestrom, and then just fully does not deliver. Like, he delivers some far out of date proof of embezzlement that's outside the statute of limitations, with some faff about reputation to cover for it. But like, he suckers Mikhail into working for him through promising him something he can't deliver.
Yeah, and there's also that really uneasy meeting where he offers to, and I believe successfully buys, half of Mikhail's former newspaper.
Yes, Millennium Magazine.
Yeah, and it's really an uncomfortable scene. I mean, I don't know another way. Like, just it's uncomfortable in the way that I guess anytime
we're going to be using that word a lot. This
it's episode. An uncomfortable film. No, but like, it's uncomfortable in the way that, like, anyone with great wealth offering to help you out, you know, or help out your business, because there's just this question of like, how much choice do you have? And even like, his partner says, you know, we don't even have 6 months. Like I told him, we have 3 months. And it just feels like not even a choice for them to accept this money.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the thing. And that's how these evil, that's the thing. I feel like we were saying, this movie manages to connect all of these things. You know, it manages it, in some ways it's an intersectional film where it's talking about, you know, patriarchy and violence against women, capitalism, the church, and violence in a way that is very specific to Sweden, because Sweden was technically neutral during World War II. But in the same way that like Switzerland and Spain were, where it's like, we're not technically fighting, but, you know, if some Nazis want to use our railroads to invade Finland, we're not going to say no. And so, it is like, it's an incredible accusation.
Accusation. Indictment? Yeah.
And not, I've used indictment way too many times this episode already. But and it's nice that even though this is the American adaptation, they kept the action in Sweden because it was too specific to Sweden to move it anywhere else. Like, I mean, other than Switzerland, like another ostensibly neutral country, I don't think you could write this movie anywhere else, you know?
Yeah, it definitely feels at home in the cold, in the frigid cold winter. With the kind of harsh Nordic architecture.
Yes. That's it. I love that line that Mikhail has when he first arrives in the town, and the lawyer says something like, it's lovely in the spring. And he said, you said it was lovely in the winter.
I know. I thought that was really funny because I was like, wow, even people from cold places complain about the cold. I love that. Solidarity.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the bisexuality.
Let's get into it.
Because we're actually recording this on what I think might be Bisexual Awareness Week, although I feel like I've been reading that it's Bisexual Awareness Week for 2 weeks on Twitter, and I can't tell if that's because no one knows when it is or just I'm on Twitter too much. So
when I just think bisexuals are a little messy, you know, a week, 2 weeks, who cares? We can't sit in chairs properly. We can't sit on the calendar properly. But yeah, let's get into it. I've been looking forward to it. And again, I would say, I feel like this, the question of Lisbeth's bisexuality is kind of tied up in the fact that this is a franchise that never got a payoff. Because the one scene where we see her have sex with a woman, that character came back. That character was going to come back in the next two movies and actually be like her on and off girlfriend. But again, because of the sort of abridged nature of it, we just get one scene with her, which is
that's really interesting.
Yeah, but let's talk about Lisbeth as a bisexual. Like, what are your thoughts?
Icon. Girl boss. Yeah. no, I mean, genuinely, it was really refreshing because we so often talk about films where
it's coded.
It's coded implied. Or yeah. And it was just refreshing to have a character just, yeah, I guess it's just nice to have a character hook up, you know, hook up with a woman, hook up with a man, be bisexual and
present as queer. Like, to go back to her look a little bit, like, that's a very queer look, and it's a very out look as well, which is kind of nice sometimes. Like, I'm not everybody has to, you know, dress a particular way or look a particular way to identify as queer, but you know, there are certain fashion choices and styles that sort of advertise it.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see that.
Yeah. And it's funny because, like, it's funny. I guess you're right. I didn't, like, clock it as queer. I think just because I see it as so, like, goth punk.
Totally.
And, but I definitely think it's a look that is not catering at all to the male gaze. And they even address that in the film with her gross caseworker saying,
yeah,
do you think that thing in your eyebrow makes you look attractive? It's like, guess what? That's not her purpose.
Yeah, guess Believe what? It or she not, doesn't care.
She doesn't give a fuck. Yeah. Yeah, I thought, I don't know. It was just, it was nice to have a, like, she's just an icon. She's an icon.
She's
out there. Like, I love a character who is really good at computers. It's one of my favorite tropes of all time. It always happened in Disney movies. I feel like there was just someone who was like the hacker.
Yeah,
I love
there was
that
just
trope.
Specs, get us in. Yeah,
yeah, and I love that we have a bisexual hacker.
Yeah,
I love that she is just so. I love that she's never in danger from Martin. Really.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know,
it's she rescues Mikhail from the big bad rather than the other way around.
Yeah, and there's never a moment that it seems like he's going to get her. He immediately flees, and she immediately chases him, and says to Mikhail, "Can I kill him?" And it's just like so satisfying to have
it
a bisexual
really
who follows through.
Yeah.
You know,
my one regret is that she doesn't kill him. Like, it would be so badass to see that, but
I know.
It's still pretty cool. She does cause him, it's like, she very intentionally causes him to crash, but, you know. And also, just quick thing, when they're in the torture chamber and she, like, sneaks up on Martin and hits him, what does she hit him with? A golf club. A symbol of patriarchal wealth. Anyway.
And also, there's so many weapons in his home. I mean, not so many, but there's like a lot of guns.
There's quite
and
a few.
Knives.
There's knives. There's guns.
It's just great. She reached for his leisure activity.
like worst comes to worst, I'll fuck up his 9-iron at least.
Yeah, really. I guess his second leisure activity, since it seems like his first leisure activity is serial killing.
Yes.
but on his off days, I don't know.
On the weekends, he goes golfing.
I also like. It's funny. I found her relationship with Mikhail really endearing.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that too. Yeah,
I just liked it. It's funny because, like, I think since 2011, you know, in 2011, I don't know that anyone was making fun of Leonardo DiCaprio for only dating 25 year olds. And so,
yeah, I think he was only two or three deep at that point.
That's true. But that's true. That's a good point. But I don't know. The age difference is pretty significant. So as I was watching it, I was like, huh, I wonder if this is going to feel different than it did when I first watched the film. But there's so something about their dynamic that is just so like Mikhail is so not helpless, but he's so much less skilled than her.
Is. Yeah, he's soft. He's a cardigan, you know?
Yeah, he's a journalist. He doesn't really have the skills that she has.
And he's very intelligent, but, like, not, like, he doesn't have survival skills on the level that she does.
Yeah, and there's just something about their relationship that I've actually just found really cute. And I was really heartbroken at the end when she feels rejected by him and throws the jacket in the trash. I was like, especially the moment where they're in bed and he finally asks her about her childhood. It just felt really beautiful because there's so many films about tough women or like tough women with this big, big, you know, outer shell. And then like someone breaks through their shell and finds out everything about them. And like, it explains everything. And what I loved about the scene that we get, that's a version of that is it's not like, oh, he figures he unlocks the key and like understands her personality. And then she's solved
as a person. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like him expressing genuine human empathy and curiosity and not pushing too far into what is clearly painful territory. And I don't know. I really loved it.
I love it too. I love their whole dynamic. Partly like to talk about the age difference, he's the one who raises that like, whoa, I am much older than you. And she's the one who initiates their relationship. So like,
it just doesn't feel scummy the way it can feel in a lot of movies where it just feels like, oh, right. We're all supposed to go along with the idea that
the
like
middle-aged guy, you know, bags this super cool, super hot 20 something.
Yeah. And we're all just supposed to believe that like it's just like that women have an early expiration date while men are just like constantly
age like a fine wine.
Yeah, and like there was something about this that just didn't have that kind of level of scummery.
I mean, I think it helps that Daniel Craig really has aged like a fine wine. Like that man today, I would bang. Like 2011 Daniel Craig, even more powerful.
That's really funny.
And it's funny, like something you said earlier reminded me of a quote I read where it's like, This movie kind of takes the piss out of James Bond, where like, here's Daniel 100%. Craig, here's James Bond. He's incredibly smart and a good investigator, totally useless in a fight.
Yeah.
Totally useless. Whereas like, you know, Bond is like impossibly competent and, you know, Mikhail is just a guy.
Just a guy who is so polite. It's so interesting. That
it nearly gets him killed.
Yeah. When he goes back into Martin's house, it is so, because you feel it as an audience member. You feel the tension of him crawling around in this house in the first place and then of him trying to escape. And you feel this moment he has to flee. And when he doesn't, it is so baffling and yet so human.
Yeah.
And like there's never one moment where you feel like after he goes back into the house, there's not a single moment where I have any hope for Mikhail. Like,
I know.
Once he's tied up and he tries all these lies that Martin immediately is like, you're lying. You're lying. You know, and it's incredible. The helplessness.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. And the fact that Martin is like lectured, like he's done this so many times that he knows everything that Mikhail is going to try to get out of it. And all he can do is just sit there and wait. And then and be saved by a super hot, you know, emo goth punk girlfriend.
I love it.
Oh, man. That's the thing. And it's again, it goes back to that sort of dual protagonist thing, which makes the script so interesting, that even though Mikhail is the one who starts on this mystery first, Lisbeth is the one who sort of ends the threat, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's just it's a very well balanced dynamic, I think, is really what's at the center of it.
It's such a good team movie. Yeah.
I think it comes down to the exchange they have the morning after they have sex, where it's like, I like working with you. I like working with you too.
Well, that's what's so funny about the relationship too. It's so cute and endearing, and also kind of just like two workaholics. Like, yeah, even at one point when they're fucking, she's fucking him, and he's literally like talking about the case.
And she's like, wait, wait.
Yeah, and she's not even offended. She's just like, I'm busy. Like, give me 1 minute and then we can discuss.
That's the thing. I love their sex scenes together because they feel so honest to how sex actually happens, where it's like, sometimes you're thinking about work during sex and you have to stop yourself.
And sometimes your work is unraveling the deep, dark family secrets.
Oh man. And I do love the scene with Mikhail and Harriet when they finally find her, how they relate their situations to each other because they were both victimized by the same man. And the line he has at the end of it where she asks how he got away and he says, someone helped me too. Or someone saved me too. How open he is about it and how grateful he clearly is. Like, there's no, you know, I think in an American film, often if a female character, like call it a Marvel film, whatever, a female character saves a guy and he has to make some self-effacing joke about it or blah, blah, blah. Like, even something that's good, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer has moments of that. Mm-hmm. And this movie just doesn't have time for that bullshit. It's like, he was gonna die. Elizabeth saves him. He is grateful, as he should be.
Yeah. What did you think? Because I was so torn on the end of when Harriet and Heinrich meet again. Because on the one hand, I love that she was still alive. I think, and not just still alive, but like alive because of help she got.
Yeah,
a lot. You know, her own desire to escape her, I think, cousin, right?
Yeah, her cousin, Anita. That's the thing, that she asked for help and received it.
Right, and that it was also two younger women in this fucked up family of abuse.
Every authority figure failed them, even Heinrich, the one we like.
Right, and that they took advantage of the narratives of violence against women to even escape, to be like, don't take anything. They'll just think you were disappeared, murdered, not a runaway. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was just such a good twist that she lived after all of like the horror that is what, you know, Martin and his father's like trail of bodies. But I was really torn at the end about whether or not I liked that they brought her back. There was part of me that just wanted them to lie to Heinrich and just be like, because even though he is ostensibly the good one in the family, there's a certain point where you just got to write everybody off.
Yeah. It's tricky. I see what you mean, that tension. I mean, I definitely think that, like, speaking of her being alive at the end, I think it's the perfect twist, because in this movie of so much darkness, it ends on an actual, like, a believable happy ending. And also, like, I saw, I think it might have been Mara herself or Fincher said something about, like, you know, no, it was Rooney Mara says, like, you know, Lisbeth Salander is a young woman who lost her childhood, and now she's drawn into a case where she's looking for a missing child, basically. Like, obviously, this is years ago, but, and so the fact that this missing girl is alive in the end sort of is a commentary on her character, where it's like, she's still alive. There is still, like, she has not been so traumatized that she can't have a life. And, you know, to present a narrative where someone overcomes childhood trauma rather than being defined by it, I think is very beautiful.
Definitely.
And bringing Harriet back, I wonder, because I think it, if again you take it metaphorically, you could see it as, you know, they've killed all the Nazis, they've killed the serial killer, they have removed the part of the family that was causing harm to a certain extent, or at least the most immediate harm.
Yeah.
And I do think it's important to show her reconciling with Heinrich, even because he's sort of a father figure who failed her, as a way of saying, like, you know, forgiveness is also possible, where it's like Heinrich never meant to hurt her. He just, you know, missed this. But yeah, it's tricky. It is really complicated.
I think it's just funny because, like, I don't know that it felt like this to you, but to me, the moment when Heinrich says, "What did he find?" That actually felt like a huge moment of like, I didn't know what they were going to say next.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, are they going to say
nothing?
Nothing.
Or, yeah.
Or, and then, and yeah, for her, or are they going to say she's out there, but
we're not going to tell you where.
We can't tell you where. And then for her to actually be there, it was, but then also when she embraced Heinrich, I felt that classic movie emotion of like, yes, long yeah. lost family.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's very That's interesting.
Yeah. It's, I mean, like any family, it's complicated.
No, this is not like any family, though.
Like any family, like, they've got two Nazis, two serial killers, a creepy alcoholic who just, you know, says really mean shit to people. Yeah. Oh, man. That's the thing. It really is like, it is kind of fascinating how it's like an onion. You peel away each layer and the family just gets worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. And to go back to what I was saying about like spiraling, it's so interesting that the initial quote unquote clue that even gets Heinrich to think of it as a serial killer case, which is this recurring birthday present he got, you know,
yeah,
actually ends up just being what it seems to be on the face, which is a birthday gift.
Yeah. And also, like, I think that's so interesting because you could almost take it as Harriet was trying to give Heinrich clues that she was there somewhere, but that she didn't want to be found. And then he because there was no actual communication, he interpreted it as her killer trying to drive him insane.
It's a funny twist.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, the first time I saw it, I was confused by it. But the second time, I feel like it's almost a further commentary of like, yeah, if you see the world through this lens, that's what you're going to think. But if you actually try to connect with people, you can see their true intentions.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good one.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
Man, that's the thing. We could go on for four hours.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, what more is there to say? And also, how can we stop recording?
There's so much. No. Like, I didn't even get to the sound design as much as I wanted to. I wanted to go off.
The music and the sound design is really good. And also, there's some moments in the sound design that are truly gross. Like, yeah. I don't know if you noticed, but
like the revenge scene?
The revenge rape sound
effects.
It's
so wet. Oh my God.
It's a lot. It's a lot. It's a lot. Brother.
Was that the scene you had in mind?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's burned in your brain. The Foley artist really had a day with that one. And we've really had a day with the girl listening to this podcast. thank you. Wait, we need to do Fuck, Marry, Kill.
Oh.
And in this movie, you could do the same three to one person. God. Oh, my God. Who are we going to pick?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I can do it for this movie.
I mean, Lisbeth McHale.
What about like an investigate?
Investigate. I mean, there's so many people in this movie I would like to kill. But if we include them in the three, then you're going to know right away.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'd marry Martin Vanger. He's very wealthy. No, I'm going to kill him.
Yeah, no, he's going out first.
Okay. How about this? I've got it. Lisbeth, Mikhail, Erica, Robin Wright's character, like Mikhail's business partner.
Fair enough.
Yeah. We can live with these three. Do you want a friend zone instead of kill though?
There's so
much killing in this movie. I don't want to hurt any of them.
Yeah, I agree. We've seen enough violence.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So I'm just going to say right off the bat, I'm going to marry Elizabeth because I want to see what's on everyone's computer whenever I want. And she made that seem very easy and very fun.
Yeah. Oh, my God. We didn't even talk about the final act when she's, like, doing some real spy shit and, like, wearing wigs and stuff. And it's so badass. Yeah. Yes. So you're going to marry Elizabeth.
I'm marry Elizabeth to look at everyone's computers whenever I want.
Totally.
Which is maybe fucked up. Just look at some computers. I just want to look
just
at some.
Just for, you know, billionaire criminals.
Yeah. Billionaire criminals. And also, like, she's great. Yes. Yeah. I'm going to fuck Miguel because it's a vibe.
Yeah.
And I'm going to friend zone, what's her name?
Erica.
Erica, because I think she's got to sort out her marriage. And yeah. Even though I love Robin Wright.
I mean, it seems like she has. It seems like she and her husband are pretty cool with her sleeping with Daniel Craig. And frankly, I would be too.
Okay, what's your
picks? I would take one look at him and be like, damn, I would too if I could. Go for it.
Go for best of luck to you.
That's it. I'm going to flip two of your answers and say I would friend zone Erica like you did. Mostly because, like, yeah, she's fine. She's cool. She runs a magazine. That's cool.
She's just not a big part of the mystery.
Yeah. And yeah, like she's just very pragmatic, which is a good quality in a friend. But I'm going to marry Mikhail. Because can you picture the two of us in our little sweaters and a quilt with some hot cocoa on a winter night? Just like relax and watching a movie. Yeah, that's more my vibe. And I would fuck Lisbeth, though, because I wouldn't fuck her. She would fuck me. I want to be pegged by Elizabeth Salander.
Oh, my God. That's so funny.
I'm not even kidding. I would be genuinely interested in that.
I'm gonna be honest, I'm not doubting it. I'm not hearing a single iota of hesitancy in your voice.
Not even hesitant. I am enthusiastic.
You fall enthusiasm.
I am down to be pegged by Rooney Mara
or Elizabeth Salander.
yes both. Either
DTP.
And you know who else I'm down to be pegged by? The girl listening to this podcast. Thank you so much for listening to Sails and Oysters, your bi-weekly bike. I really thought you were going to let that transition go.
That's so funny.
Thank you for listening to Sails and Oysters.
Like single girl.
Haven't you noticed? I've been doing that for weeks. I've been saying the girl listening to this podcast.
No, this is truly the first time I've noticed that.
You never know.
That is so funny.
Anytime I need, not every time, but like whenever I need a transition into the credits, I'll say, you know who else is a serial killer in Italy? The girl listening to this podcast. Thank you for listening.
That's really funny.
That's really, oh my God. Yeah, now you'll hear it every time I do it.
Now
But yes, thank you for listening. Biweekly, bicoastal, bisexual. If you like the show, rate it, review it, subscribe, share it, yada, yada, yada. If you really, really like the show, bada bing, bada boom. Patreon.com/snailsoysters to sign up for $5 a month to be a certified bi ally. For that $5, you will get monthly bonus episodes and my film diary where I record my thoughts on every damn movie I see.
Also, what else did we say at the end? Oh, yeah. Thank you, Abby Austin. Did our beautiful art. Thank you, Bailey Libby. Did our bisexual music. Both their social media handles are in the episode information section.
Yes, indeed. And in that episode information section as well, you can find links to the videos I was talking about and our social media as well. Snails and Oysters is at Snails Oysters on Twitter. Shoot us a message if you disagree with one of our Mary Fuck Kill takes, or you think the Swedish version is better. You'd be wrong, but or you just have an idea for a future episode. We are always looking for more bi movies, so please help us out. And until next time, I'm Matt Roberts.
And I'm Allie Rogers.
And thank you for being a bi ally in our hunt for Swedish serial killers. Oh.